Coming up, Lav and I break down everything you need to know about this week's Ryder Cup. Welcome to the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. It was another epic week on tour for Callaway drivers. On the PGA Tour, Maverick McNealy, Mark Leishman, and Taylor Gooch all finished in the top four with epic drivers in their bags. On the European Tour, the winner of the Dutch Open relied on an epic speed driver, and Callaway was the number one driver brand on both the LPGA Tour and the Champions Tour. Epic has won four major championships in 2021, along with Xander Schauffele's men's gold medal in Tokyo. For more information on Epic's tour success, visit callawaygolf.com. Lav, you've landed in the land of cheeseheads and Spotted Cow, which is now both of our favorite beers. You walk the golf course. I'm going to just go ahead and start. What are your impressions?
It is very much like we saw the 2015 PGA in terms of people falling down. It is not a user-friendly golf course from a spectator's perspective. And I think this will be different than some of the home Ryder Cups we've certainly seen over the past decade. You think of Medina, you think of Hazeltine, most recently in 2016. The fans were really on top of you, and you got a sense that the noise was just a little bit louder because that environment was more conducive to having those types of acoustics. I don't think that's going to be the case at all at Whistling Straits. It's just a massive ballpark. And with the wind coming in off Lake Michigan, you're just not going to get that same effect. But I mean, the golf course visually is absolutely spectacular. And it's going to look great on TV.
I would agree with you outside of the first hole. I think there's going to be something special. And look, the PGA.
What a massive structure. I'm not sure TV's going to do that justice, just how big it is.
It isn't. And on Monday, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, I kind of snuck down before we were allowed to sort of walk down from the putting green all the way down to the first tee. It's 146 yards, by the way. And it's probably the longest 146 yards in Ryder Cup history, because you can imagine that as a player makes that walk on Friday.
But remember in France, they had the whole bridge.
You had to go into the tunnel.
That was cool.
That was really cool as well.
Go down the stairs. No one fell.
And I have to give it to the PGA of America and the European Tour when it's overseas. And it's funny, I actually had players talk to me today about the idea that those massive grandstands on the first hole, they're not even close to the size of what they were in Paris. Like, Paris was over the top. And so a lot of that has to do with logistics and what you can fit in there. But it's still going to be really cool. And they've created this atmosphere that's unlike anything else in golf. And that's one of the best parts about the Ryder Cup in my mind. Now, it is worth pointing out, and to lift the veil a little bit and let people see, you and I are not only in the same room doing the podcast.
Oh, just horribly breaking COVID protocols.
We're wildly too close to each other because someone forgot their microphone.
Yes, did forget my microphone. Did not want to have any buffering issues. We're sharing a villa. And I was making the point to someone, this is the first time since March 2020 that in the media center, we're actually sharing the same workspace pod. Normally, they've been separating us up 6 feet. I guess COVID does not exist in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. I have no problem with this. I'm fully vaccinated. I do have a little bit of a sinus infection, but that seems like a new problem at this point.
We seem a little too cozy, and we'll get into some COVID stuff because it has come up in the context of.
I want to get your thoughts on the golf course since you brought it up. You've always been a proponent, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. That you should have some sort of neutral body setting up these golf courses. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like they've gotten too extreme. I mean, the Golf National was a claustrophobic setup by any stretch of the imagination. You had thick rough, very narrow fairways, and slow greens. This golf course, there's really not that much you can do. You're kind of dictated by what Pete Dye did with the land and the whole layouts. I mean, certainly the first cut of rough is negligible, but you do still have the tall, wispy stuff that you're used to seeing in the PGA Championships here. The greens are very large and undulating and quick, although probably not as quick as you maybe have for a major championship just because of the winds this time of year. But what do you think you're going to see the typical advantage that the Americans would have by having a home Ryder Cup?
No, and I wrote that earlier this week. And just to be fair, every time we point out Paris, I think it's almost obligatory that you have to point out that Hazeltine National was set up for the home team, like Davis Love. Exactly. He knew exactly what he had with his team, and it was a whole bunch of bombers, and he wanted them to make a lot of birdies, and that's what he set up there. So it's not as though this has been one-sided or the other. Both captains for both teams have done this. But as you pointed out, this golf course just doesn't lend itself to that.
Do you think they can act? So obviously the American strength is hitting the ball long and making a lot of birdies. That is the American strength. There's no doubt about it. Everyone 1 through 12 has that sort of attribute in their game. I'm not sure you can make whistling straights a track meet. I'm not, unless you're putting every single pin in a funnel, which is basically what they did at Hazeltine. I mean, this is just a difficult golf course. I was standing out there on the 17th green for about a half hour today. The wind's blowing 25 miles an hour. No one's getting close to that flag. I mean, it is a very difficult golf course anyway. I'm not sure they can set it up in such a manner that it really is conducive to that sort of environment that the Americans would really want to have in this.
And I feel like Stricker wanted to. I think when you look at the players he picked, it was the guys who make a lot of birdies. Certainly Scotty Scheffler, who's, I would argue, is pretty much the only true rookie on the team when you consider President's Cup experience as well. The problem is, as you pointed out, the winds. They howled today. They're not going to blow quite as hard. It was interesting. I was talking with Paul McKinley today about this, and he said it feels more like a European venue.
Yes.
And it almost feels
100%.
Like it
that
has
was my first impression walking the golf course.
And it almost feels like it has backfired on the United States having it here, because the Europeans, just watching them today, they seemed much more comfortable in this golf course than the Americans probably are. And look, that's by design. Like, the way they wanted it, they wanted a lot of birdies. I don't think they're going to get that if the forecast holds.
It seems like a Shane Lowry golf course and not necessarily a Bryson DeChambeau golf course. Like, you almost have to think of Bryson this week as playing an Open Championship venue where he's going to have to flight the ball. He's going to have to think more creatively than just tee it up high and bomb it. Because we know exactly what's going to happen in Bethpage when the Ryder Cup returns to U.S. soil in 2025.
There'll be no rough.
There's going to be absolutely – they're going to buzz that thing.
Yeah.
And they're going to tip it out and say, all right, DJs and the Brookses and the Brysons of the world, have at it.
It looked like Augusta.
And the U.S. like. Probably won by 5 or 6. This seems to me like it's probably going to get closer. We're going to get into predictions here, but that's just kind of my sense.
So I'm going to follow the guidelines of what we did, and you can check out golfchannel.com for our punch shots. Because I think the way we set it up was pretty cool. So I'm going to go straight to man of the match. Who do you like?
So my pick for man of the match, and you could go in any number of different directions here. And keep in mind that this player is also, their performance is contingent on how their partner plays, right? You have four team sessions. And so for my pick, I took Justin Thomas. And this is probably not a surprise to anyone listening to this podcast, because I pick Justin Thomas for man of the matches. I pick him to win player of the year every year on the PGA Tour, just because I'm a huge fan of his game. There's zero weaknesses. But I took him this week for a couple of reasons. You think of how he has done over his last three cup competitions, President's Cup and Ryder Cups. He is 10-3-2. Let me say that again. He is 10-3-2 across his last three cup competitions. That, of course, includes the 4-1 performance in Paris in the 2018 Ryder Cup when he was a rookie, when no one else played worth a damn. That is by far the best mark of any player on either side in recent memory. I also like the fact that he's probably going to be paired at least once, probably twice, maybe even four times, with his good buddy Jordan Spieth. And I think that pair, especially in foursomes format, will be very good. And I also think this is an opportunity for JT to kind of seize the reins as the new leader of this team. Tiger is not here, even though he's, you know, feeding information to Steve Stricker. Phil has been relegated, not just as a player, but now he's an assistant captain's role, and his scope is kind of limited. Justin Thomas can be that new leader for this next generation. I think he would relish that role. I think he would embrace that role, and I think he'll thrive in that role.
So you don't think DJ would step in as the oldest player on the U.S. team?
Dustin Johnson, the man of few words, to be a leader?
No. Just asking.
No. Justin Thomas is a leader through his actions and, most importantly, through his words.
No, I can see that. And I like JT. I think, and this is going to speak to where you and I are obviously leaning on our picks on this one, but I'm going to go with John Rahm. I just think when you look at the way he has played this season, and somehow, some way, the world number one shows up this week with a chip on his shoulder. Don't ask me how, because all you have to kind of look at is what motivates him. And if
the player of the year snub?
The player of the year snub, the fact that he won the small print with the strokes scoring at East Lake to Patrick Cantlay, the player of the year vote to Patrick Cantlay, whatever happened at Memorial where he's leading by six, wasn't able to go to the Olympics. I can keep
really
going.
Motivation.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's going to motivate
him. It's
only
motivating if he plays Patrick Cantlay in singles.
And look, this all boils down to form. And I think when you look at John Rahm's form,
well, battling stomach issues in Napa.
I don't know how much he was really putting into that started Napa, considering what was on the line. Let's just look at the playoffs.
He put something into his stomach because it was coming right out.
That's like, wow, way to get gross.
You should read that press conference transcript.
No, thank you. And not to segue, not that there's any segue here whatsoever, but we're staying in a condo that has two rooms in it. And it's a very nice condo, but
it's a villa. It's a villa.
But the villa that Ryan has actually has a bunk bed in it, and it has a regular bed as well, but there's bunk beds in there. And so the deal was tonight I would buy him dinner if he sleeps in the bunk bed. And so I
didn't even think twice about that.
You didn't even pause. You were a bit of a fool on that front. So check Twitter for
top bunk. You're
top bunk or a bottom? I'm going why top?
That just brings back good memories. I had a bunk bed as a kid. I had a bunk bed first year of college. I always slept on the top.
Oh, wow. Oh, all right. Because you realize this is like your one chance to get sleep. You've got a newborn at home. You've got a toddler running around.
Lily is sleeping very well.
Really?
Yeah. Right. She sleeps at least three.
So you're not using this as an opportunity. No one uses the Ryder Cup as an opportunity to sleep.
The bet was one night, correct?
Oh, yeah. You don't have to.
Right. Yeah.
It wasn't that expensive of dinner.
I've got five nights. I can suck it up for one.
Okay. So if I buy dinner again tomorrow night.
So then I have to do it again?
That's the way it works, yeah.
Maybe we'll try the bottom one.
All right. John Rahm is who I liked, and we sort of transitioned from there to what pairing do you think will be most influential?
So I don't even know if this is going to happen.
We don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think in particular, I mean, we could go through the U.S. pairings right now because they seem pretty obvious based on Stricker's words and the pods that we've seen. The Europe, I have absolutely no idea what we're going to see. I think probably Wednesday's practice session gave us a better indication. I was pretty optimistic. I was not on site on Tuesday. I was pretty optimistic we would see a Roy McIlroy, Victor Hovland partnership, which is what I really wanted to see. I think Roy McIlroy, this is a perfect golf course for him. He's been playing better over the past couple of weeks. It's a long hitter's paradise. He can just absolutely air it out. From the shots that I saw, he was very dialed in. And Victor Hovland, there's a reason why the other 11 European Ryder Cuppers all voted to have Victor Hovland as their partner for this week. He has a game that is perfectly conducive to not only this golf course, but this type of format. He's never going to get you in trouble if you put him in foursomes. He has such an easygoing demeanor. I mean, if you're Padraig Harrington, you're running Victor Hovland out there five times and not thinking anything of it. So I think if you pair those two together, it'd be a dynamic duo. I just don't know if it's going to happen. That's wishful thinking on my part.
I like that. And it was interesting back at East Lake, Rory was asked about Hovland and he made the point if he would be in demand by a lot of the members of the European team for all the reasons you just pointed out. However, sort of off to the side, Rory said, yes, I would love to play with him, but it's probably not going to happen. Simply because if you look at Rory's position, if you look at his status on that team, he is the guy that every 2 years he takes the hardship pairings. Like he is going to pair with whoever the captain needs him to be paired with.
He paired with Poulter and at Medina.
He gets his good ones. He gets his share of good ones, but he's also a team player and he's willing to play with anyone. He'll ride or die with anybody.
He's also good with Tommy Peters back in 2016.
Absolutely. So I think he's willing to take chances. So I don't know. I would like that. I think the one I lean towards, and look, this is contingent, in my opinion, on the U.S. team success. And again, we're going to get into our thoughts on the outlooks of which team has the opportunity to win or has the chance to win. But it's got to be Patrick Cantlay and Xander Schauffele in my mind. Because you look, Steve Stricker has a lot of things going in his direction. And I said this earlier tonight, I've done a lot of radio interviews over the last few days, and I feel like I've walked away from every single one of them feeling I just took a big poop on the U.S. team because I'm just not very high on them. Again, we'll get into that later. But the reasoning here is
– thank you for keeping the PG on this podcast.
This time around, did I not do that at dinner?
No.
I did not. Nope. But this time around, he has two really, really good built-in pairings. Justin Thomas, as you just pointed out, and Jordan Spieth, that's a magical pairing. Xander and Patrick – they have the opportunity to be that exact same magical pairing. Now, if you just do the math going forward on this, if those two pairings are somehow able to produce those 3-1, 4-0 weeks even, that suddenly the American side is sort of on the front foot.
and they have an opportunity to put the pressure on the European team. So I think if there's a truly important pairing for either team, it's got to be Xander and Patrick.
I would agree. And I actually think it's funny that I'm not even sure there's a backup option. Like, I don't think there's a plan B. Let's say Stricker sends them out on Friday and they somehow go 0-2. I don't think it's going to happen the way Patrick Cantlay's playing and Xander Schauffele. Certainly, I don't think that's going to happen. However, if it does,
do you
send them out there for a third try? Do you sit them on Saturday morning and try again Saturday afternoon? I mean, I really don't think there is a plan B. I think a lot of players would like to play with Xander Schauffele. I think Patrick Cantlay's probably an acquired taste in terms of partnerships. But, I mean, those two are ride or dies, and Stricker's counting on them to bring home some points.
And it's the rare combination, and Stricker talked about it this afternoon, that when you try to put these pairings together, you want two things, right? You want two players who are in form, and both these guys are in form. They're both playing very, very well. And you want two guys, in theory, that like each other. They not only like each other, they're legitimately very good friends. This was all born from the 2019 at Napa. This was all born from the 2019 President's Cup. They were together. They got to know each other. Patrick Cantlay said it only the way Patrick Cantlay can, that, look, under any other circumstances, I would have kept him at arm's length because that's what we do as competitors. In this particular case, I had to embrace him, and I realized I really, really like this guy. And that usually produces a good pairing. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to go 4-0.
It is interesting. The President's Cup, it was the first time they played in team competition together. Certainly, it was the first time they were even on this type of stage together. 2-2. And team play when both are foursomes matches, alternate shot, and went 0-2 in four balls.
And that's going to be key.
You would think that that would be the case again this time. I mean, you'd be hard pressed. I mean, JT and Spieth is a very formidable foursomes team as well. But an alternate shot of Xander Schauffele and a Patrick Cantlay, two guys who really don't stray off the fairway all that often or put themselves in trouble. I mean, they're at least going 1-1.
You're doing the bobblehead thing with your head. I can see it.
They're at least going 1-1.
I can see it, and foursomes is important. Again, talking with Paul McGinley today.
Traditionally,
the Americans have just gotten their butts handed to them, and they know it. PG, they've gotten their butts handed to them, and the Europeans know it. And we're starting out Friday morning in foursomes, and if whatever magical formula Stricker has come up with, if somehow we don't come away at least 2-2, the United States, $5.
Oh,
put it in the pot, $5.
Wow,
and dinner. First one.
Can't wait to the end of the podcast too, when you predict who your team will, which team will prevail.
We will win. You'll have to decide. But I think going forward, I think that's going to be key. And to your point, Xander and Patrick could be the keys there. All right. So moving ahead, the third question of our punch shot was who will be the two most important players for each team. I think we both kind of touched on them already, but I'll let you go first.
Let's start with the U.S. side, since that's probably most familiar to our audience. I'm taking Kyle Morikawa. And the reason I'm taking Kyle Morikawa is, fact of the matter, 3 months ago, after Colin won the Open Championship, he was king of the world. I mean, he was a two-time major champion at age 24, had only been done just a handful of times in the history of the sport. And you would have thought in that moment, oh, Stricker's going to run this guy out five times. I mean, this is going to be the American's best player. He was the highest-ranked American in the world rankings. He has such a game that would be just absolutely ideal for foursomes play, and yet it's exactly what happened last fall when Colin Morikawa won the PGA Championship. He fell off, and now this time it seems to be a back injury. That's kind of the reason for his dip in performance. He did have a good week at the Olympics where he lost a playoff for the bronze medal, but he was still battling a back issue there. He has declared himself 100% healthy, just as he did throughout the FedEx Cup playoffs, even though his results suggested otherwise. Well, he was absolutely dreadful. As you know, losing the fantasy golf challenge. Actually, where is that shirt that you're supposed to be wearing during the captain's press? Did you leave that at home?
I didn't leave it. I actually forgot to ask my wife to make it.
Okay, so we'll have to figure something out on that one. But as you are unfortunately very familiar, he entered the playoffs first and ended up finishing, I think, 26th, which is very uncommon Morikawa-like. He appears to be set to play with Dustin Johnson, the former world number one in team play portions.
I got to think that's a four-ball pairing.
Oh, I would think that'd be foursomes.
You think so?
Colin Morikawa, his iron play?
Oh, well, I think it would work actually both ways now that I
think about it. Yeah, I would want to lean on him for foursomes play. But the point and the reason why I think he's most important is if he has a good week, if he has the week that he, I think, months ago would have projected him to have, if he goes 2-1, 3-1, something along those lines, I mean, that's a huge head start for the U.S. trying to win back the cup. He's an important player for this U.S. side.
So you're saying as Colin Morikawa goes, the U.S. team goes?
I think he is extremely helpful because he makes a lot of birdies. He's a streaky putter, but most importantly, he's a great iron player. And with half the team formats are mostly about iron play, then yeah, I think Colin Morikawa is an important player.
And I think iron play with the wins in this particular golf course is going to be crucial this week. I went with something a little bit more familiar, and I've already made the argument of why Rahm's going to be the man of the match and why he's going to be crucial to the European side. I think
– What was your U.S. guy?
The U.S. guy is Patrick Cantlay. I was getting to that. I just feel like he has all the makings, and I don't want this to come down to – someone asked me today that how cool would it be if it came down to John Rahm and Patrick Cantlay in the final match.
We've seen it. We just saw it.
We've already seen it. I don't need to see it. And it's the same idea of you know, how dismissive that I've become about all of the and this is a social media thing where everyone is just screaming for, well, you got to pair Brooks with Bryson. Well, no, you don't. And it would be ridiculous.
See, I actually do think.
No. Come on.
They should have. They should have put Brooks and Bryson out in four balls.
Make me believe that.
Okay. There's a couple of reasons why. Clearly, you didn't see my tweet when I put this out there.
I did.
So I'm sure you read the Golf Digest article where Brooks is basically ambivalent towards Ryder Cup.
Yes.
And how he's in, you know, he doesn't get up.
Although I defended Brooks on a lot of those points, but yes, go
totally
on.
Agree. And yeah. I don't think he's the only one who believes that.
No, absolutely not.
So putting those two together could A, lean into Brooks's individualistic approach where you can just go say, hey, go beat Bryson. Go make more birdies than Bryson.
The Patrick Reed, Jordan Spieth thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Those two jived because they wanted to beat each other's brains out. Mm-hmm. Brooks and Bryson would have that exact same scenario. Reason two is the fact that Brooks craves a partner who has high energy. He told me that. He said if Patrick Reed plays on this 2021 U.S. Ryder Cup team, he wanted to play with Patrick Reed. Now it seems like he's going to be paired this week with Tony Finau, who is the opposite of Patrick Reed, or a Daniel Berger, who was DB straight five. And
well, and he and Tony played in Paris together, yeah. And they actually had some success.
They were fine.
Yeah.
But Brooks wants that type of high-energy partner. Third, I think most important, is those two players are showmen. They're showmen. They like the stage. They want the pressure. They like the attention. What could be bigger than a Brooks-Bryson pairing at the Ryder Cup, which is the most compelling golf tournament, bringing in all sorts of non-sports fans who have probably been drawn into this feud that they've had in the past couple of months? That would be the perfect stage for them to really showcase their talents. I was all in on a Brooks Bryson four.
You got ratio. You got ratioed on that. You totally got ratioed on that.
Well, I kind of leaned into it, saying I've been kind of sleep deprived, but here's something I've been thinking about in the wee hours. I really do think it could have and should have work, but Stricker was never
going to
do it.
And I'm gonna debate the last point. I kind of agree with the first two points, but the last point that they're both showmen. No, these are two vastly different. When it comes to personality, these are two vastly different.
When Brooks chipped in with the Phoenix Open, he literally said that he wanted to turn around and say to the guy, hey, watch this. I'm going to chip this in.
No, I agree. Brooks loves the stage.
He enjoys the role of the entertainer.
No, he loves the positive feedback. The second there's any negative feedback, we've seen it time and time again. There's all about the Ryder Cup is all about negative feedback. Eventually, you're going to get punched in the mouth.
Pro-American. Because of the travel restrictions, this is probably going to be the most partisan crowd at the Ryder Cup.
I'm not even referring to what they're going to get from the galleries. And I would argue that there's going to be a fair share of Brooksies in Bryson's directions this week, regardless of the partisan gallery.
They're not going to toss them out.
They might, but I still think it's going to be so many people. It's going to be such a zoo. There's going to be so much alcohol being served. There's going to be plenty of Brooksies out there. I'll just say that, regardless of the red, white, blue and
right,
everything
but
else.
If they win together, if they go 2-0 in four balls, 2-0 in four balls, this thing's over. The silly feud's over.
So you're the guy that would have argued for Tiger Phil before Hal Sutton fell on the sword and did Tiger Phil. And it was a huge, huge failure.
No, because Tiger Phil didn't work for a lot of reasons, but most importantly,
and this wouldn't work for a lot of
because
reasons.
Those two are by far the Americans' best players.
I don't know. I don't know. You could say that week. I mean, I don't know necessarily if you would argue that week
in 2004.
Well, I just don't know that Phil. He never
won a major.
He never before the playoffs. He never showed up to that thing in any kind of form.
Still the two best American players.
Well, they just didn't get along. Is the point here?
Who's the two best American players right now?
You're not going to put Patrick Cantlay in that conversation.
I put Patrick Cantlay as America's best player right now.
I wouldn't put Brooks or probably Patrick and Bryson, maybe.
Bryson?
I mean, Morikawa was hurt.
I put Justin Thomas.
JT, sure. Jordan.
He's kind of dipped off a little bit, but yeah.
You're not making your point, though.
No, my point is that those two are not the most important American players. Tiger and Phil were. And so when you throw them out there together – as their best players, you're leaving the rest of the roster basically fighting for scraps.
Let me get this straight. Your strategy is you're going to throw these two out like you're in Vegas.
Yes.
And you're throwing down.
I would have 100%.
And you just don't want craps because you're just gambling. And I could lose big or I could win big. Is that what you're thinking here?
They're both hard to partner with. Put them together. If they're going to lose, why not lose together? If they're going to implode or punch each other, have the cancer separated.
If
Steve Stricker's a surgeon, remove the cancer and put it to the side.
And this is already a big enough zoo. You're going to add.
Yes. This is an exhibition.
Well, now you've stepped over the line.
It's a spectacle. Lean into it.
No.
I think it was a big mistake.
I think you're sounding like a crazy person right now.
No.
There's no way.
There's a lot of people who agree with me. I think there's a lot of people who think that Brooks and Bryson would be a good idea in four balls. Let Brooks go try and beat Bryson. Let them have the stage they all want. Give Brooks this high-energy partner. Have a motivation for Bryson to play well because this feud is over if they win. If they go 2-0, this thing's over. They're going to go play their little match in November with Phil and some other player.
I don't think Phil's in the match.
Okay. Well, they're going to do their little... Going to do the little thing in November, and everyone's going to get all ginned up because, ooh, it's Brooks and Bryson together. You could have totally subverted that.
You just sat here and nodded your head like a bobblehead when I said that, and it's important that Cantlay and Schauffele play together because both are in form and they're such good friends. And you were like a bobblehead doll. Yes, yes, yes. Agreeing with all of it.
Yes.
And now you're going from the other spectrum saying that let this hatred simmer between
different
these two.
Different formats. Camaraderie is super important in foursomes. I think you legitimately need to be friends with your foursomes partner. That's why I think JT and Spieth are so good.
You certainly don't need to hate someone. That's important to point out.
Four balls, who cares? You're doing your own thing. You don't even need to talk to them. Go make birdies. Go make nine birdies.
Again,
together.
Tiger Phil being the primary example there. It did not work.
Didn't work for a lot of reasons.
It didn't work for a lot of reasons, but I'm telling you right now, it didn't work primarily because neither one of them wanted to be paired together.
You don't think Phil wanted to be paired?
With Tiger Woods? Absolutely not. And look, the animosity went wildly one way in this relationship. That if you look at the anecdotally, if you look at the history of those two, there's plenty of stories that we've heard from Tiger towards Phil of a distinct, I don't want to say hatred, but there was a dislike between these two. You have not had that with Phil going back to Tiger Woods. However, I don't think Phil embraced that pairing any more than Tiger did because he knew it simply took an event.
Phil wasn't even embracing the Ryder Cup that week.
Exactly.
I mean, that was.
He had to go to.
Predestined to fail.
He had to go to another golf course to practice with Tiger's ball because it had to be so secret. That's how secret it had to be that week. So it gives you an idea.
I think Stricker could have proved a point. I would have loved to see it, and I just don't think it's going to happen. How about Europe? Who's your most important? We got sidetracked. Who's your most important player for Europe? I'll go first. It's Jon Rahm. You've mentioned him. And the reason why I say that is because it's really hard for me to envision a European victory this week without Patrick Harrington relying heavily on his studs and just riding them into the ground. Jon Rahm, he's not the most experienced player. He's not I wouldn't call him like the heart of the team. I think that's Rory McIlroy, the heart and soul of the team. But he's Europe's best player. He's not just Europe's best player. He's the best player in these matches, period. And if he doesn't show up, and if he doesn't have a good week, if he doesn't have a record that's well above 500, it's hard to see Europe winning this.
Yeah.
John Rahm, yeah.
No, I would agree. And that's why I made him the man of the match. And I made the most important player on the U.S. side, Patrick Cantlay, because again,
your John Rahm's your most important too?
Yes. In my defense, I don't know. And look, Rory needs to have a good week as well. And we can all agree with
needs?
That. Well, needs for the European team. Yeah, for Europe.
For those guys.
Not for Rory.
Not our team.
I said Rory. I said them, Europe, and us.
Them and us.
But no, he needs to have a good week as well. But this really comes down to John Rahm. And it's amazing to me that you go back to Paris and if you're can be a fly on the wall in that team room on Saturday night when he is down in the dumps, he's moping around knowing John, he's probably breaking things in the team room. And the captain, Thomas Bjorn, goes up to him and says, "I'm putting you with Tiger tomorrow." He already knew. Like, I'm putting you out against Tiger. And John...
Because Tiger just shot 85.
Yes. But
in the previous two rounds.
And John is not happy with his game. He doesn't feel like he's done anything for the team.
He's better than Tiger was.
He's down in the dumps. And suddenly you're putting against the best player of the generation. And it challenged him. It challenged his manhood. And he went out the next day and he beat Tiger Woods. And from there, it has been nothing but a beeline from that point to world number one, winning major championships and everything that went to
go. I'll never forget that Ryder Cup in 2018 when Tiger Woods, he literally just won the tour championship, his drought busting win, his first win since the back surgery, right? He'd been 4.5 years removed from his last win. I think it was Bridgestone in 2013. He was 4 days removed and he stumbles away from the range and just plops down in the back.
Exhausted.
In the back of the golf cart, throws his arms back, tilts his head back and goes, "Ugh, F." And they drive off. That is my enduring image of a 2018 Ryder Cup. I mean, he left everything out there, the tour championship. He was completely gassed.
He had nothing in the tank for Paris. And I don't know that
he's ever going to be a team competition.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, besides, I mean, playing catch and roll.
Probably. And it's interesting because you could flip that conversation to the European team. And there's so many of those 40-somethings now.
This is their last stand.
I have to believe. So, I mean, I'm the one that wrote off Lee Westwood. I'll own it. I'll take the bad take on that one. Like, you don't have to rerun the sound. I said that he wasn't going to make this team. And he may end up.
But you said that about Victor Perez.
I was right on Victor Perez. I don't know that I should have been right on Victor Perez. I feel like he really should be on this team. Because that is a mountain of a man, and I don't want to anger him anymore.
He does not use gloves. He likes to use his hands.
I never want to anger him again. The final question, then this is what we're coming to, the crescendo right now. Who's going to win? I give you the floor.
It's the U.S.
You say matter-of-factly, it's obvious. Sorry, I didn't realize.
And I'm not sure it's going to be particularly close.
What is not particularly close?
So let's put this in perspective. We have not actually had a good competitive Ryder Cup in 9 years. It was a 7-point margin of victory in 2018.
You're going to Medina.
It was a 6-point margin of victory in 2016. And it was a 5-point margin of victory in 2014. The U.S. would not have lost on home soil since 2004, which was just a dark period in U.S. golf history. When you look at the players who were on that team, they would not have lost on home soil if not for just a crazy comeback slash choke job in 2012. I mean, they've been pretty dominant when it comes to playing on their home golf course. And you look at the strengths of this U.S. team. They're not relying on a Tiger and Phil anymore, which was never going to be a winning recipe because of their Ryder Cup record was terrible. But they have the depth now to swap in players and to kind of go players who have a specialty, a Bryson who is a four-ball specialist, or a Harris English who is going to always keep the ball in play and can play in foursomes. Or you have those teams like a Xander and a Cantlay who could really excel in this foursomes format. I think they're just deeper and stronger. I mean, Europe's got a lot of players who have some question marks. Tyrrell Hatton hasn't played well in months. Lee Westwood, you're really gonna trust Lee Westwood's putting? Sergio Garcia and Ian Poulter, you're really going to make putts forever?
I mean,
how many times have you asked these same questions?
Your time's up.
You've asked these same questions for a decade now.
This is the last stand for the Garcia, the Poulter, the Westwood. I mean, Justin Rose isn't on this team. Stenson's an assistant captain. I mean, this is the last of the old guard. If the U.S. can win this one, and I think they will win this one, I think you're looking at the next decade of potential dominance towards the U.S. side, not the European dominance that we've seen of late.
I agree with you in as much as I feel like this is a tipping point Ryder Cup.
Yes. If the U.S. loses this, it's an all-out crisis. Task Force 2.0.
Yeah. But the way I look at this is one way or the other, because it's the old guard of Europe going out, and you're right. I think this is a swan song for a lot of players.
Paul Casey,
probably. Ian Poulter, certainly. Sergio, certainly. Lee, obviously.
Lee West was the captain in 2023.
Well, depending on what he does with the Super Golf League, I mean, I think that still remains to be seen. I was thinking about this the other day. This could be the last time we see him in a Ryder Cup sitting, depending on what he wants to do for his future. So that's a whole different conversation.
The thing's still alive?
It is, because there's a lot of money. And where there's money, there's hope.
I don't think
quote Rory McIlroy.
Just buy us out. They can buy our allegiances.
I will agree with you in as much as this is going to be a tipping point, that the Europeans are turning the page one way or the other, and the Americans are turning the page one way or the other, that we have these young players. And look,
JT is the new heart and soul of the U.S. team.
And as I've said, as I said earlier, I've done a lot of radio interviews this week, and I've walked away from all and feel like I have just taken a big poop on the American team. And I don't want to do that, because I feel like what Steve Stricker has done with his picks.
Boys. You said we earlier.
I did say we, and that's going to cost me $5. It might cost me 10 if you keep leaning into it, so please stop. I think what Steve Stricker has done as a captain, he's left no stone unturned. He certainly is overprepared, just like he said he wanted to be. He got the players, the six players he wanted in his captain's picks. I don't think he got the golf course he wanted, but that was kind of up to Mother Nature. All that being said,
the PGA America deal. Who's paying a lot of money to.
They went to Wisconsin in the fall, which was always going to be iffy. So I can kind of get where you're coming from. The one part that stands out to me is, like, Vegas doesn't get it wrong very often. The wise guys are the wise guys, because they normally have an idea of what's going to happen. The fact that they have the Americans as a favorite, slight favorites, not big favorites, slight favorites, baffles me, because that is ignoring recent and relevant history to an extreme. Because all you have to do is 9-12.
We just gave you the relevant history.
We've heard
it. Not for a choke job / comeback in 2012. They would have won convincingly at every home Ryder Cup since
9 out of 12. That's the only number that's important here. And we've heard it time and time again, mostly from the Europeans. That's how many the Europeans have won. 9 out of the last 12 matches. And you can make the exact same argument that if not for what Davis Love did in his second turn as captain at Hazeltine, tricking up that golf course, which is what some people would argue, if not for the magical, whatever the magical formula was for Paul Azinger in 2008, if not for...
That's magic formula was Nick Faldo.
But probably. And if not for Ben Crenshaw's ramblings on Saturday night at Brookline, that it would be 12 out of 12. Like, I mean, you're trying to spin this. And the last time they played, it was a 7-point blowout. It wasn't even close.
Look, they're nowhere near winning on four. So there's a reason they haven't done since 93.
Well, and my argument is this European team is not that different from the one that was in Paris 3 years ago. For better or worse, they're older, they're grayer, they're slower, they're fatter. A lot of them. Lee Westwood, I'm looking at you.
Shane Lauer. Like,
he wasn't on that team. He's a freshman. He's a rookie. But it was the exact same team. So explain to me how things are going to be so dramatically different.
I just outlined it for you.
No, it just doesn't happen. You're ignoring everything about history, and you being
these guys are older, fat. What was your?
I think fatter was in there.
Get older, fatter,
grayer.
Yeah. Probably
frumpier,
slower. That's 2 years more of decay on your 3 years more decay on your putting stroke.
Maybe
nerves are frayed.
Maybe
hit it shorter.
And forgive me for my weak comment. There is nothing I want more than a close match. As a journalist, I just wanted to come down to the last match on the last hole.
From our perspective, there's nothing better than, well, yeah, a close match. But B, an American loss. An American loss is fodder for the next 2 years.
I don't agree with you on that, because I have endured too many. We have endured too many of these. When I've left too many.
You talk about from a selfish perspective.
Yes.
An American loss is way better for business than American win. There's no doubt about it. The amount of hand-wringing,
the second guessing, the Golf Today segments, the columns that we're going to write on golfchannel.com, the podcast that we're going to do, the Golf Central podcast presented by our proud sponsor, Callaway Golf. Like, we are going to light it up if the Americans lose.
Oh, absolutely.
They should win. They're Vegas said they're the favorites. They clearly have a better team. I mean, their world ranking is like an average of 20 points better. Of course they should win. They're younger.
No.
They're on home soil. Of course they should win. You write it on Sunday night. We'll do a couple little – we'll certainly do a recap podcast. And that's it. American lost fodder for 2 years.
No.
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
No. And this is journalistically, I just want it to be a close match. Honestly, and it doesn't matter to me which team wins or loses, despite the fact I threw the Wii out there. That's now going to cost me about $20, I feel like. I just feel like if you can get to the point where they're close, and I've made this argument about the President's Cup. Forget about who wins.
If it comes down to if it's close.
If it comes down to the last match.
Then it comes down to who's the better player.
That's
fine.
And
the American has that in spades. Americans have that in spades.
But they... Always had that in spades. They've always been paper tigers. They've always had the better players. And yet, nine out of the last 12, you still can't duck that number. They've always had the better players. They've always been the.
Look what happened on home soil.
And again, we have pointed out that this is not home soil. That this, we have said time and time again, this feels like. It's going to be very partisan towards the Americans, the golf course, the conditions, the way everything feels. It's going to be very European. It's going to be very French. It's going to be very Spanish. Whatever you want to throw out there. It's going to be cold. It's going to be windy. It's going to be rainy. All of those things that the Europeans. You have your rain jacket.
I didn't rack my wellies.
You did not?
No.
Your first Ryder Cup.
Wisconsin in the fall.
Really? First Ryder Cup?
So basically your whole thesis is that until I'm proven otherwise, until I'm proven wrong, I'm just going to keep riding the Europeans.
Until they get knocked off the mountain. Absolutely.
So you have no statistical basis for this. You're basically just saying, like, they've won 9 of 12.
Statistically, the Americans should have won 12 out of 12. This shouldn't even be a conversation if we're going to go into statistics. If we base this on the world ranking, the Americans should win this year in and year out. And we know through history that just isn't.
Why they don't win on European soil.
In American soil, you can keep making excuses, but that's not going to change what they did.
They were destroying the Europeans in 2012 until Saturday afternoon happened. They were destroying them. They were up 10-6. It could have been worse if not for some late theatrics.
Your revisionist history is getting insane because you keep talking about how they should have won this and they should have won that.
Yeah.
They didn't. The final outcome is 9 out of the last 12 have gone to the Europeans.
There's a reason why that was a historic comeback slash joke.
That's a fluke.
Yes, of course it was. Otherwise, it would happen every time.
I just don't see where you're coming from for this. I would argue
it's called a fluke because it hasn't happened before.
I would argue that if Davis Love doesn't trick up Hazeltine National, that we're talking 2 out of the last 12. Well, you shake your head like that. And if Ben Crenshaw doesn't conjure whatever ghost he conjured on Saturday night at Brookline, we're talking 1 out of the last 12. So you and I could both make these exact same arguments.
I don't know what you want me to say. But
you're wrong?
But then the U.S. did win those.
Well, that's my point. So in Europe has won 9 out of the last 12. So I will give you your 3.
Also, your little magic of Azinger. That was a 5-point margin of victory. What was the margin of victory in 2014? 5 for the Europeans. 2016, 6.
They're not close. I will give you that. Yeah. They're not close. I don't know why you seem to think this one's going to be close either.
So you're predicting a European blowout?
I think I will coin the phrase of a colleague of ours at dinner tonight who says, I think the Americans are going to win, but if not, the Europeans are going to blow them out.
But
it's going to be close.
But you didn't pick the U.S. to win.
I did not pick the U.S. to win.
So what are they going to lose by?
Again, this is me probably thinking with my heart instead of my head. I would say it's going to be close because, again, we want it to come down to the last matches. We want something to write about. We want something to talk about. I don't think it's going to be particularly close. I would put it in the 3-point range.
You think the Europeans are going to win by 3 points?
I don't think that's – they won by 7 last time. Yes, I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility.
Come on. You hear it here for folks. Rex Hager, Europeans will win by at least 3 points. We're going to have to cut this clip. It's 8:02 p.m. local time on Wednesday night. Kaz, if you're listening, we're going to cut this clip and replay it back when the Americans not just win, but win convincingly. Rex, is there anything else you'd like to share on that podcast after what is just a criminally hot take to close this one out?
Again, I don't want to poop on the American team. I feel like Steve Stricker is doing a lot of the right things. I like the next generation.
What has Steve Stricker done wrong?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Like I'm
you
not.
You know, Podrick's gonna out-tinker himself.
You keep thinking that. I don't know why you think that. I don't know why.
He is the most prolific tinkerer in the history of the game.
We had this conversation at dinner earlier tonight, and both captains this week have referred to, I've played for good captains and I've played for bad captains. And the immediate question is, who's the bad captain?
If only you could get the moderator's attention to ask a follow-up.
You can't. Could you? It's going to be a long week for you, isn't it?
Got a way of not, apparently. Who knew? Just trying to ask a question in person.
No, I think what's interesting to me is Podrick and Steve seem to be cut from very, very similar molds. Both kind of blue collar.
You would never see that. You would never think that those two would be two pieces of pod.
No, but blue collar, working class kind of guys. They both have gone through ebbs and flows in their careers and proven that they can fight their way out of it. And I don't think either one of them are going to leave a stone unturned.
Win or lose, Steve Stricker cries, yes or no?
I took the 4-1 bet. It's a good prop bet. Yeah, absolutely. He cries.
Yeah, he's definitely going
to
cry.
I don't think he can make it through the opening ceremony.
I think he can get dusty.
He kind of got a little dusty yesterday. A local reporter asked him, I guess his daughter had won some sort of high school match yesterday that he obviously couldn't attend because he's busy. And he got a little dusty yesterday. So, yes, absolutely he cries.
Maybe he just has an affinity for local news.
You're a girl, Dad. You should know this.
He's only 2 weeks older. There's much more to uncover. All right, Rex. I look forward to seeing your prediction become woefully incorrect. We're going to have to do the recap pod probably, what, Sunday night? I think we're both driving to downtown Milwaukee for our flights home early Monday morning. We're going to have to do a recap pod.
Sure.
On Sunday night.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I look forward to the clipping clipping what you said and throwing it
right, happily, rerun it. Happily.
Right back in your face. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. We will talk to you guys on Sunday night when we will have a winner of the 43rd Ryder Cup.